Welcome to ESAM's Global Economy Podcast and a new season of interviews with interesting thinkers and scholars in everything from trade and political economy to ideas and the health of global politics. My name is Fredrik Eriksson, and today I'm talking to Oscar Guinea. Oscar is a colleague of mine at ESAIP. He's a senior economist that previously has worked, among other things, for the European Commission and the Scottish Government. And today, we're going to talk about globalization and a new paper that Oscar just has released. Globalization comes to the rescue. How dependency makes us more resilient. Oscar, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you very much for having me, Fredrik.
So it's a pretty provocative title in this paper, because COVID-19 is perceived by many to have ushered in much greater urgency in decoupling the European economy from trade and the dependency of other countries. Some say that we've been naive and put so much dependence on other countries and their exporters. You take a different line, in fact, a radically different line in this new paper. You say that dependence on others makes economies more resilient. What do you mean?
Yes, Frederick, that's right. We take a different line. It's a paper that was released recently that me and our former colleague Florian Furtuber wrote during the summer. And from our point of view, dependency is what has helped countries around the world to face COVID-19. From our point of view, we think that globalization has been good. And we think this is because of three reasons. The first one is that when you look at what China and other countries which were larger producers of medical goods did, is that they also import large amounts of medical goods to face the pandemic. So it was basically, it was not that they couldn't produce medical goods and protective personal equipment that was needed, is that the amount of demand was huge. The second reason is that producing these things on yourself, or just one country producing every single good that you might need for a pandemic, it's really complex and is, I would say, unrealistic. Or as Phil Hogan, the former commissioner for trade, would say, it's a pie in the sky. And the third one is that let's assume you want to produce every face mask that you will need to for your continent, let's say Europe or the US or China. It will be very expensive. And it will be very expensive, not just expensive. You will have to diverge a lot of resources of things that you are good at to start producing face masks. So in a way, it will be diverging your resources from something that you maybe have a comparative advantage to something that you previously import and now you have to produce. So in that sense, we think that globalization has been good for countries when they face COVID-19, has been necessary for small countries and has also been necessary for big industrial regions like the US, Europe, or China, or Japan.
So let's come to the COVID-19 experience, and especially the European experience in the beginning of the year, in March and April, where we had shortages of PPE and other medical goods that were necessary in order to have hospitals being ran as usual and being sort of for doctors and nurses to be able to take care of patients that came in. But let's start first to talk a little bit more about globalization generally, and perhaps not in relation to the COVID-19 experience. Is it your argument that sort of in general terms, economies that are open and get dependent on others, that they are also more resilient? Is that sort of your line of argument?
That is kind of our line of argument. I mean, we have to be frank about what COVID-19 was. It was an unexpected shock. You cannot prepare for these shocks like you budget your budget for education or your budget for capital investment. You know that something might come, but you don't know in which form, you don't know when, you don't know how. But you know that, so rather than, you know, preparing in terms of every possible eventuality, we are going to produce every single good that we might actually need. because we don't know if the next pandemic will affect the lungs or will be bad for the kidneys, or it can be a nuclear disaster. We basically don't know. So it's better to build systems that are flexible. So being able to import is one of these tools that countries can have, import from different sources and being open to trade. It's one of the tools that countries can have in order to complement the domestic production. Because when a shock like COVID-19 comes, when the next shock will come, then what we have learned is that your production capacity will be affected. It will be either because you might not have the inputs from other countries, but it was also because, and now I'm thinking about Europe and in my own country, Spain, it's also because many factories had to close. Factories had to close for two reasons, because they don't want the workers to be sick and to limit the spread of the illness, or because workers couldn't really go to work because they were sick. So you know, when you think about a crisis like this one, we were fortunate that we had an open trading system and we could buy COVID-19 tests, we could buy face masks, we could buy thermometers from other countries.
But at the same time, wouldn't you say that the COVID-19 crisis was pretty symmetrical in the sense that it, you know, with some time differences, it happened all across the world, largely at the same period in time? Most of other types of crises that you're talking about, they relate to typically asymmetrical crises. So Europe may have a flu season in one type of the year, and then sort of the season is going to be different in another part of the world. You may have a nuclear disaster in one country, but not in another country. You may have a heat wave leading to food shortages, but that's not going to be sort of all across the world at the same time. It will happen differently. So was COVID-19 a symmetrical shock in the sense that it happened basically to all countries at the same time? Or were there sort of particular differences here in time which enabled the global trading system to operate as a source of supply between countries that were in different parts of the COVID-19 cycle?
Well, if you go and look at the past and see how kind of... So at the beginning in January, we have the first wave in China, and we all witnessed that, hoping that there was not going to be as bad in our own countries. So it took like a couple of months to actually be as bad as it was in China to be so bad in Europe and in the US and in other countries. So there was a lag. And you can see that, for instance, or if you check the news that were reported in January, there were some critical medical goods, including face masks and protective equipment, that was urgently shipped from Europe into China, as requested by China. It's true that COVID-19 is probably the closest we can get to a symmetric global shock, but still, I think there is some lag on when do you have your peak and then when do you have to close your factories and your production capacity will be mostly damaged by that. And then at the same time, it's like diversifying risk. If you're open to trade, you might actually expect that some countries' production capacity will be affected in different ways, just because of the diversity of production. So to answer to your question, I think even if COVID-19 was a symmetric shock, there was still some lag. But if you look at a smaller geographical area, if you look at Europe, for instance, then you can see that the shock was pretty much at the same time when it happens to Europe.
And how did countries in Europe, or the world for that matter, how did they respond on the trade side? I mean, there has been talk both about countries liberalizing trade in order to ease access to critical medical goods. But there's also been a lot of talk about countries that impose different sort of trade barriers. So what was sort of the main dominant trend during this period?
So this is one of the things that we look in the paper, because we were genuinely curious, like, did the world close down or we were more open to trade? And then we look at the numbers. And it's basically what you can see from the numbers is that it is a bit of a dual strategy. Many countries reduce the barriers, the tariffs, in order to buy as many medical supplies as possible. And at the same time, they increase export restrictions to avoid those goods being exported outside the countries. Now, having said that, it's interesting as well to see that they were not only just tariffs going down and export restrictions going up. There was also countries were able to change the regulations and ease the ability or ease the regulatory burdens that they or the regulations that they impose to foreign goods. And you have that not just in developing countries, also the EU and the US. But anyway, when you actually count the number of measures, what you find is that they were more or less even, but I would say a bit more restrictive measures than liberalizing trade measures. But when you look at the number of measures that stay in place between January and July, then you find the opposite, that trade liberalizing measures were higher in numbers than trade restrictive ones. And the reason for that is that what we found is that trade restrictive measures in March and April, many of them, 28% of them, were canceled.
So that means sort of in the final tally, there were more liberalizing measures than there were restrictive measures. Is that what you're saying?
That is correct. So the number of active measures, the number that measures that stay in place during that period between January and then when you count at the end in July, that's when the data is available, then the number of active measures, the number of the measures that countries continue to have, there were more trade liberalizing measures than trade restrictive ones.
And what was the trade liberalizing measures?
Many of them were tariffs. Many countries reduced the tariffs in order not to tax foreign goods that they really needed. So they have a very inelastic demand, so they were going to buy them anyway, so why would you have an import duty on those goods? But it was also interesting to see that some of those measures were beyond tariff liberalizing measures. So we have around 77 regulations that were changed as reported by the WTO. And these regulations are regulations on conformity assessment by the EU, regulations on kind of a standard that a medical goods should have when they were bought by US hospitals. So then all the US administration allow for medical goods that were produced following Japanese, European, and Chinese standards to be bought in America without having to have US standards as well, or meeting US standards. And then many developing countries, you know, they were quite innovative. So they tried to find ways to facilitate trade, to do conformity assessment, custom checks virtually without reducing paperwork. So it was beyond tariffs. There were more regulations that were changed to facilitate trade.
All right. So let's, Oscar, move into another part of your paper, which is looking at European trade dependency more specifically. So I think sort of my main question here is to start with, how dependent is Europe on the supply of goods from other countries? What has your trade economic analysis been suggesting when you've been going through lots of different goods, looking at where they are supplied and how important that supply is?
So we approach this question with a genuine curiosity, because there was all this talk about how dependent Europe was on the rest of the world and how much do we need to reshore, we need to produce in Europe in order not to be that dependent. Let's try to look at the data and see what the data is telling us. And one of the things we did in the paper, and I think it was quite interesting, was that we look at EU imports, but we look at EU imports from within the EU single market. How much Spain imports from France imports from Germany, and so on and so forth. And then we also look at how much Europe imports from the US and China. And we put all that together. And then we have a list of more than around 9,700 products. And then we kind of break those imports between imports that came from within the single market and imports that came from outside the EU. And what we found is that for the majority of the goods, The larger market share is from goods that are coming from within the single market. So the single market is the major source of imports for European countries.
Let's come back to that later, but first ask a very specific question. Is that true also for the type of goods that we have been discussing that are relevant to especially hospitals, medical goods, pharmaceuticals, protective equipment, etc.? Is it the same situation there, that European countries are mostly dependent on other European countries?
Exactly. I mean, that's one of the things we did. Was not every good is as important as you will think for a pandemic. There might be some agricultural goods that only are coming from one specific country and may not be a European country, but you can substitute with other with an alternative agricultural product. Or there might be a specific kind of toy that you find in the data that comes mainly from China, and then you think, it will be a pity if we cannot import this toy anymore, but it will not be something that will impact the lives of European citizens. So we took advantage of the list of products that was published by Eurostat. They published a list of 118 products that were related to COVID-19. And in this products list of products, you will find things like protective equipment, and you'll find medicines, and then you will find some parts for ventilators and these medical goods that you need in an emergency situation. And what we found was that there was not a single product, a single one, none of these 118 products were import only from one country, either European or non-European. And there was not a single product from which 80% of the total imports came from a non-European country. And we also found the opposite. We found that there was not a single product for which the EU didn't produce at least 20% of the imports, of the total imports that the EU get. So that kind of means that the EU has the know-how. And it kind of reassures on our initial hypothesis that was that it's not that countries didn't, or European countries didn't have the technical ability to produce these goods. It's more that the demand was so big that no country could have met the kind of the increase in internal demand on their own, so they needed imports. We also found that these goods were imported from a wide variety of countries. On average, these 118 goods were imported from 46 different locations, different countries, EU and non-EU countries.
And that's for COVID-related goods?
That's correct. So these 118 goods were all COVID-19 related goods.
So is the implication of that, talking specifically about these COVID-19 related goods, that it's not just that we have a trade pattern where we are dependent strongly on one country, it is actually that we have a trade pattern where there are multiple or different producers in multiple countries that are actually supplying Europe with these particular goods?
That is correct. Dependency makes you more resilient, because you have a diversity of suppliers. So in this discussion about open strategic autonomy, there's been a lot of talk about diversifying imports. Are we too reliant on China or not? And it might be the case. I mean, we also find in our paper that there were around 424 products for which 80% of the imports came from non-EU countries. Our argument in the paper is that if you find that from these 400 products, by the way, none of the 118 COVID-19 related products were within that list. But if you think that there is some product for which you are particularly dependent and you want to diversify, that diversification, you will create that diversification by importing from different countries, not by relocating that production back to Europe. Why is that? Because if there was to be another COVID-19 shock, then the majority of your factories will need to close. And then you will not be able to produce those goods, and you will have to import them anyway.
I mean, that seems to be the logical conclusion for me. And I'm in that context, it's difficult to understand where the argument comes from that we should concentrate more of the production in Europe. Wouldn't we become sort of more resilient as a continent or as a European Union if we actually were dependent on more suppliers outside Europe? Because that seems to me to be sort of the logical conclusion here, because in most of the crises that we can envision, they're going to be regional rather than global. And that can be a financial crisis, could be a new pandemic, it can be a nuclear crisis, another environmental crisis, but they're going to be more regional than they're global. And the more we have a diversified supply of goods that are coming from multiple countries outside Europe, the more resilient we're going to become, right?
That is correct. And if you think about the pandemic, and you think about what had happened, you kind of realize that supply chains, value chains have actually delivered. So at the beginning, we have so many news about shortage of medical goods. And those news are no longer on TV or on the radio, newspapers. And I think that's a fantastic story, because it kind of tells you that the factories, the private sector has managed to ramp up production to the point where you have all the medical equipment that you need. And hopefully, if there is a second wave, we will not experience those shortages anymore. So the criticism of value chains kind of flies in the face of what reality, to be honest. And so we have all this news about not having enough groceries and everyone running to supermarket to buy toilet paper, for instance. And I was a bit guilty of that. I bought maybe too much toilet paper, but to be honest, haven't seen any shortage of groceries or goods that I need for my everyday life throughout the pandemic. And I think that speaks volumes about the ability of the private sector to deliver the goods that we need.
So I'm afraid that not everyone share that view of the world, Oscar. We have seen lately, or at least over the past couple of years, that there is a trend in global politics which goes in the direction of reshoring, having your own autonomy, production autonomy. More generally, we have a United States which is much more oriented towards an America First approach in its trade policy. We have other countries that are doing roughly similar type of measures as well. And now I see many Europeans talking about that we've been naive, that we've been allowing ourselves to become dependent on many other countries in the world, and that policymakers want to take action against it. So why are we having this debate?
So part of the reason for that is that when you look backwards, think about what had happened in Europe and in many developed countries, where we have seen scenes at hospital where doctors have had to use, from rubbish bags and tape to protect themselves and to treat patients. That were horrible images that are kind of they shame many politicians, and we were extremely surprised in Europe. And then the first reaction is this: let's produce this at home, and I think that's kind of is this. This first reaction of having control over kind of what is going to happen, but that control is really difficult to materialize when you kind of understand two things about this crisis. The first one is that the next crisis, it's impossible to predict what the next crisis will be. We don't know. So it's preparing for it. It's not about producing your own goods domestically. It's about building your systems that are able to cope with this with these shocks. Stockpiling could be an answer for that, but then the instinct it's kind of always to produce, to distrust maybe foreigners or not to rely on others. And I also think that part of the answer for this is that maybe during COVID we have come up to realize that supply chains cover more than electronics, and some of the goods that you will think that are essential, we no longer produce them domestically, we rely on others for it. But our paper comes to say that this is a good thing. It's good that we import from other countries because then we can rely on the production capacity of China, of Japan, or Australia, or the US, so on and so forth, in order to get as many goods as you will need. And this is what we found in the data. I think this was interesting because we looked at the increase in imports for key medical goods, for thermometers, for COVID tests, for face masks. And there is an increase on intra-EU imports, but there is also an increase on extra-EU imports. So they both complement each other.
So here's how I would see it. I agree with what you're saying now, Oscar. I think, however, that there is a much larger case that is being made in Europe right now against being dependent on other countries, because the type of policy proposals that we see coming up now, they are going pretty far beyond the type of goods that you talk about in that list of 118 COVID-19 related goods. We're talking about sort of having strategic autonomy in sectors which are clearly a long way from the healthcare sector, and that includes everything from the digital sector, having autonomy in AI or having autonomy in platforms, to more generally cutting dependencies in strategic industrial sectors, for instance. So there is a broader development going on right now in Europe, which is more similar to sort of an America first attitude than first perhaps meets the eye. I wonder if, and I'd like to hear your view on this. I mean, my argument against that, when you have a drive from the European Commission and a European Union type of approach to it, is that I wonder if this is not going to come back and bite them in the tail, because for many countries, dependency works in both directions, both dependency on non-EU countries and dependency on EU countries. And one of the experiences that many countries had during the height of the COVID-19 crisis in March, April, May, was that they didn't get the supply from other EU countries. So we had several EU countries that imposed export curbs for medical equipment to other EU countries. We had famously this story about Italy asking other countries for assistance with ventilators, respirators, but they were denied. And it actually got to the point where the EU Commission president had to issue an official apology on behalf of the European Union to Italy. But there are plenty of other countries that had similar experiences in how orders were blocked by other EU countries for face masks or for other protective gears. So is that really going to be a viable strategy for the EU? I mean, aren't they just sort of going to split member states even more from each other if they go down this line of having dependency? Because at the end of the day, for most goods and for most trade, being resilient in that definition of the word basically means cutting trade with other EU countries.
So yes, I think Frederick, I agree with you. I think it's kind of logical that you think if you want to produce everything in Europe and then there is another crisis like COVID-19, then if countries will have shortages of medical goods, the first thing they will do will be to protect their own population. And in that sense, it's quite difficult to call for European solidarity when maybe your neighboring country is not allowing orders of medical goods to go from factories in another country to your hospitals. So in that sense, it is correct. It is true that within the single market, there are rules and regulations that maybe will not allow that to happen. But that kind of flies in the face of the fact that that had actually happened, and then that probably has created some mistrust between member states.
All right. So finally, Oscar, where do you see European policy going here? I mean, do you think that it will become much more sort of Europe first focused, with an attempt to have policies that would reduce supply chain or supply dependence on other countries? Or do you see sort of that the efforts that are now being made by some countries and some parts of the European Commission to go down that line will actually be opposed by other countries in Europe, and that we basically going to stay with roughly what we have right now in terms of openness and dependence on others?
Well, I think you can separate this question in two sides. So what the policymaker, the narrative will be, and what will happen on the ground. I think we are in this talk about open strategic autonomy, or talk about not being so naive, but having a more confident industrial policy and spreading into the digital and so on. That is here to stay. And it might be actually get worse if then there's a Euro first for procurement, or there are plenty of ideas to make things worse. Then you kind of wonder if this is going to have, if this is going to have an impact on the ground, and then whether factories will start moving some of their production from China into Europe or into neighboring countries of the EU, into Northern Africa or some places which are closer. And here I think it's we need to recognize that governments do not produce stuff. It's companies who do it, and then they will take those decisions, and they will take many of those decisions based on fundamentals of cost, labor costs. Some countries can actually impact those things, but then it's not that much into the hands of the member states. What I think Europe could do and should do is to actually approach this question with more like sincere and more honesty, and say, okay, should we understand as a country, how many goods do we receive from just one location? And then they can actually measure that. But as we tried to do that with our limited resources in our paper, and we found that it was not complete sectors, it was more about 400 products, and none of them were medical products that were relevant for COVID-19. So I think here what you have is to do more like work that is not, will not make any headlines, but to understand the supply chains that, and the kind of products that Europe rely on, and understand where they come from, and then maybe I'm trying to understand, do we have to do something about it? Because it might be that you don't need to do anything about that. But for that, it's important to see the granularity of the analysis that is needed. And then that behind every product, there is a completely different supply chain. So policies that are too general, I don't think will make a difference and may actually things worse.
That's fascinating, Oscar. Thank you so much for taking the time to join this podcast. I think this is a subject that we're going to return to in future podcasts as well, because as we've talked about, there is a major trend right now, not just in European policy, but in other parts of the world too, to reshore and to relocate production back home in the spirit of making yourself less dependent on foreign supply. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Frederick, for having me, and invite every of our listeners to check the paper in our ESAIP website.